Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. It's Matthew Stafford. Good to see you, Matthew.
Good morning. Good to see you as well.
It's good to see you. I've been seeing you relatively regularly, actually, this year compared to, you know, I guess actually seeing people in real life. Matthew and I met, actually, I don't know if we did meet, but I met his organization, Nine Others, probably 8 or 9 years ago. And through a series of serendipitous events, we reconnected because every month for the last 10 years, Matthew and his organization, Nine Others, has had a dinner with nine other entrepreneurs. And over that time, that's a significant chunk of time, has a network of over 4,500 entrepreneurs in 45 cities around the world. And he's writing a book on the experience, which we might sort of dig into what he's been writing about, because obviously the network becomes quite powerful over that sort of time. He's also an angel investor in early stage startups, including What Three Words, which I saw is being used by in Austin, Texas this weekend at the City Limits Festival. He's the co-founder of Dot Matrix Group Syndicate and writes about startup investing on Substack under the moniker The Education of a Startup Investor. And he's an ultramarathon runner and is signed up to the Marathon de Saab, which close listeners to this podcast will know that I did earlier this year. So maybe we'll get on to what it's like to run long distances. And
yeah, I'm just here for the tips on the MDS, really.
I actually was a previous podcast guest called Peter Sage, had run the MDS, and his recommendation to me was don't do it. So there you go. I would say do it. It was fun. Before we get into it, I just remind everybody, this podcast is brought to you by my company, The Tech Department. That's the one that I blew up, hence calling the podcast Honey, I Blew Up the Business. We blew it up. We made a mess of it, but we turned it around. And I learned a lot from doing that. And I don't want to do that again. So that's why I'm talking to Matthew today and all the entrepreneurs we've got on this series. And the aim is to help people like you, other entrepreneurs, to avoid my mistakes. So if you like what we're doing, if you like what the podcast is trying to achieve, please share it with your pals and stick it on social media or give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts particularly. So do us a favor, help us out. We're trying to help other entrepreneurs. So let's get into it because Matthew's got a really interesting story. But I want to kick off actually with a thing perhaps more recent, but you deleted your LinkedIn account, which I think fries people's minds when you tell them. I have observed it fry at least one person's mind when you told her. Why did you delete your LinkedIn account?
I did. I did that at the end of last year, on the 31st of December at around 11 o'clock, 11:30, that I decided that I was just going to delete it at the end of last year and get rid of the whole thing. And it was really, LinkedIn was really sort of getting to me last year. It's been incredibly useful in years gone by. It is a great network. You find some great people on there, you know, that's all smashing. But I think the last couple of years, and I think maybe it's because of how I was using it or I don't know what I was looking at, it was just really getting me down. So how I decided to do it, and this is sort of linked to the MDS as well. So I was up north for Christmas last year. So I'm from the northeast of England, and I was up there seeing family at Christmas last year. And we're sitting in me and my family, we're sort of kicking around before dinner. We got a couple hours before we're going to go down and have dinner. The kids are on messing about on their iPad. My wife's watching something on telly, and I'm sitting there scrolling through LinkedIn, checking for updates. And then I switch to Twitter, scroll through Twitter, have a look at what's going on, go back to LinkedIn, see if there's any more updates. And I thought, oh, for goodness sake, this is a complete like waste of time. And it was cold and wet and drizzly and foggy outside, but I changed into my running kit and I went running around Northumberland on that evening. And a couple of things. So I was sort of stumbling around the fields of Northumberland doing a run in the dark and the wet. And it just felt so good. I felt so, so much better than looking for updates on LinkedIn. So I thought, right, I'll think about it. But by the end of the year, I just want to get rid of that. So that was one decision. And then I sort of stopped for a break on my run And I just happened to get an email saying that I had the chance of a place on the MDS, the Marathon des Sables. And I thought, okay, when I get back to the, when I get back to my hotel, I'm going to sign up to get a place at the MDS. And I decided to delete LinkedIn. And then between then and the end of the year, you know, I thought about it a bit more and I actually looked into it and I sort of really, really did some proper sort of analysis on it. And none of the investment opportunities that I've backed, none of the, you know, none of my co-founders, none of my, you know, business contacts, you know, people that come to dinners, people that I invest with, people that I get on with, people that I've become friends, none of them actually originated on LinkedIn. I mean, we were all connected on there, but they didn't actually originate on the LinkedIn. And the things that did originate on LinkedIn, like the people that found me there and wanted to connect and then messaged, the vast majority were just out for what they could take and out for just selling stuff. So I thought, right, that's it. I'll just get rid of it. And like anything, it's an experiment. So I thought I'll just delete it for a few months and see what happens. So then, so I did at the very end of the year. I just got rid.
We'll call this episode "Honey, I Blew Up the LinkedIn Account."
I've since gone back.
Have you?
Yeah. So it was an experiment, and it was a bit weird in the first few months of the year because I did feel like I was missing out. And, you know, you don't get the likes on posts and you don't get comments and you know, I didn't see anything that was going on. So I thought, oh dear, this is a terrible mistake. You know, I'm not going to cope with this. But then, you know, just kept going. And then by February and into March and carrying on, I mean, I just never noticed and didn't miss it at all. And then, yeah, I had a coffee with you and someone came over and we had a chat and you introduced us and that was all very nice. And she said, like, oh, great, I'll add you on LinkedIn. And I said, oh, I'm not on LinkedIn. And she was just shocked. And and the funny thing was, when I started telling people, like I was at another event with investors and somebody there was saying, oh, I'll add you on LinkedIn. And I said, oh, I'm not on LinkedIn. I got rid of it. And they're like, oh, I wish I could. Oh, that's so great. I thought, well, why don't you? You know, it's quite easy. You just get rid of it. So then, anyway, so I did that in the first few months and felt really good, felt much better. And then, you know, September came around and I always love that run from September to the end of the year. And, you know, for one or two reasons, I thought I might need this for business. So I went back onto it, but I started from scratch and, you know, using it in a completely different way. So no app, no notifications. I don't get an email if anything happens. I go into my browser and I open up LinkedIn and I see if, you know, anyone wants to connect or there's any messages or anything like that. And if there's not, I just close it and move on. And it's been a lot better since then.
Interesting. So what's the thing you've learned from your deletion and re-entry into LinkedIn?
I think we've all got to engineer situations where we can get away from technology. You know, especially social media. I think it was just getting me down in the last few years, you know, all the sort of vanity posting and nonsense that people start to put, you know, maybe I shouldn't take any notice of that, but you know, I think I did. And I think we all do, you know, LinkedIn, a bit like people criticize Instagram, you know, it's kind of showing off the tiny part of someone's life. That's amazing. So you don't see it all. And if you keep seeing that sort of stuff, it, you know, can make you feel envious, make you feel like you're not achieving what you ought to. But they can be useful tools. So I think, you know, it's okay to have them, but I think we've got to engineer whatever works in our lives to take a break or to use them in a more responsible way. So that it doesn't affect us quite so badly.
Interesting. It is very true, actually. And I think there's that sort of humble brag LinkedIn thing where people, it's always the kind of wins or even if people are talking about the downs, it's always framed in a way that it's all fine now. You know, and it's like, it's always slightly kind of cringy when you see people taking a photo of themselves in a hospital bed, keeping it real or something. It's just, there's a sort of tone to the whole thing. So you found it was like impacting. In what way was this kind of this vanity posting, which again you all know is nonsense, but it does sort of seep in on a subconscious level. In what way was that kind of like getting you down?
I mean, it's difficult to admit, but I think it was a bit of envy, really. You know, where I'm here living my life, and then, you know, trying to work hard, trying to, you know, do good things with nine others, trying to find interesting investment opportunities, trying to do good work. And, you know, you're always kind of thinking, always wanting to be successful and achieve your potential and all the rest of it. And I just think, I think you just, yeah, see a lot of those humble brags and this sort of vanity posting, and kind of know that it's nonsense. But you kind of think, oh, I should be doing, you know, I should, it's that should word, I suppose. Should I be doing that? I should be doing this. I should be doing something else. You know, based on being bombarded with other people's, you know, best lives. It was just getting too much.
Interesting. So this is your moment of the moment of truth when you deleted LinkedIn and you signed up to the world's toughest foot race. The Marathon de Saab, for anybody who doesn't know, is six marathons in 7 days in the Sahara Desert. So signing up for that thing is no mean sort of aspiration, I found it great fun. But so you have this real clarifying moment where you kind of resetting and setting this other kind of ambition. I want to actually screech and go into a slightly different gear. And can I go back in time a little bit? Because this is interesting how like this sort of thing came to clarify in the last couple of years, sort of the patterns that were sort of perhaps not working for you. But sort of, I'm interested to sort of go back, screech back up, because you've got this really interesting sort of path where you've gone from literally growing up on a farm, which is possibly the least tech startup investory type of background up in the Northeast, through to this world where you've got this very kind of, I would call it 21st century career of building a network that turns into investment opportunities within new technology. And I'm just curious, how did you get onto that path?
Oh, crikey. Like you say, I grew up in a farm in the middle of nowhere in Northumberland, you know, always did all right at school without putting too much effort in. Kind of breezed through, I think I sort of say breezed through my GCSEs. I tried the same approach for A-levels, but it didn't work. So I did, you know, hardly any work. And I think I got the results that I deserved. But I always thought I had a brain. I was never going to be a farmer. You know, farming was fantastic in the 70s and early 80s. We had, you know, an amazing life and it was an amazing place to grow up. But in the 90s, we took an absolute nosedive and, you know, wasn't the career that I wanted. And, you know, I'm forever grateful to my parents for showing that I didn't have to do that. You know, my father really didn't have a choice. He was going to be a farmer, whether he liked it or not. You know, that was the path for him. So I think because of that, it kind of opened my and my brother's eyes to the greater world out there. So, you know, there was never any danger of me being a farmer. I mean, if I'd wanted to, I could have done, but I wasn't going to do that. And I always fancied, you know, being in London, the buzz of the place, the diversity of the place, the forever changing, exciting part of London, you know, I was always going to be down here. And then I guess, you know, I left school and did a couple of things. I went to work for John Lewis for a couple of years. I left there with a colleague and started a t-shirt company, ran that for a year. That was kind of lots of ups and downs. And then a mate of mine was working in IT for RBS and, they were hiring everybody and anybody. This was like 1999 for the Y2K bug. And, he got me in to talk to his boss. And I think I just convinced his boss that hardly knew the front of a computer from the back. But I think I convinced his boss that I had the right attitude and I would work hard and pick it up. So he, you know, he took a chance on me and hired me for that job, in IT. And I loved it and, you know, worked there for a few years. Our bit of RBS was taken over by the Bank of New York. So I worked there for a few years, you know, enjoyed the technical part of the job that we did. I was in the consulting department. So, you know, we faced off to huge clients, big fund managers, but it was kind of like, you know, we faced off to the business side of things, but then internally faced off to the developers. And I quite liked that, that sort of translation role, understanding a bit about tech to, you know, fix things and break things. But then also facing off to the business to kind of translate that back to what they wanted. And then, you know, I was working for an American bank, 9/11 happened. There was a bit of a downturn. They started getting rid of people in 2002, 2003. And there was me with a couple of crappy A-levels and a bit of work experience. And all the better consultants had a technical background. So I thought, okay, can I do something about this? Could I go to university now? And I always, even with my crappy A-levels at the time, I always thought that I could go back and do it later, you know, do something that I wanted to do. So in early 2003, I started exploring and applying to universities to do, you know, computer science. And again, I think another guy, you know, there's these sort of pivotal points in one's life. And the first was my mate's boss who sort of let me into RBS. And the second was the director of undergraduate studies at Durham University. And, you know, I'd applied to Edinburgh because I was living in Edinburgh with the bank. I'd applied to Edinburgh. I'd applied to Napier. I'd applied to, you know, some in the Northeast because my girlfriend, now wife, was living there. So I applied to Newcastle. I applied to Northumbria. I applied to Sunderland and Durham. And Durham was by far the best university. And I think all of the others bar one rejected me. But then, you know, this guy from Durham invited me for an interview. We had a chat. And I think, again, I convinced him that I would show up every day and work hard and try and learn fast. And he took a chance on me, gave me a place. So then I did a, you know, 3-year undergraduate computer science degree with all the very bright 18-year-olds. And I hadn't studied math since GCSE. So that was a long time ago. And a computer science degree is pretty much half a maths degree. So I had to work my backside off. But I loved it. And I think that sort of gave me an insight into, you know, what was possible with technology and what wasn't possible with technology. And I worked really, really hard and did well. And that afterwards, I think it was just a massive confidence boost. It was like, you know, I do have a brain and I now got a piece of paper to prove it. So that was that. And then I continued working for software companies. It got a bit more boring, actually. Not that going to Durham was the be all and end all, but I think it was such a confidence boost that it wasn't quite so hard anymore. And I just had more confidence about what I was doing. And I wanted to work hard as well. So I'd worked hard at university, worked really hard, and I had that appetite to work hard in a job. But I wanted to get the rewards for it as well. And working for huge software companies or huge banks, you know, you can work your backside off, and there's some people working really hard and there's some people, you know, not hardly showing up at all. And it really doesn't make a difference. They sort of still get the same kind of pay rise each year. They still kind of get roughly the same bonus each year. You know, it had no massive meaningful impact on their lives financially. And I had this big appetite to work hard. So I started working for smaller and smaller companies. You know, hoping that would make a difference, having more of an impact at a smaller company, but still it didn't really. And then a friend of mine had gone to business school and done an MBA, and that had really given his career a boost. So I thought, oh, well, I'll do that. You know, I've got a brain. I can go do another degree now. So I did. So I applied to a few business schools. I got into Imperial College, which was the best fit for me. And I did that 2 years part-time whilst I was working in one of these software companies. And that's what opened my eyes to venture capital. And, you know, I'd been aware of the tech startups while I was studying at Durham. You know, things like Facebook had launched, Twitter had launched, Gmail came along. So it was obvious, it was clear that these startups could go from nothing to something very quickly. And then at Imperial, I learned about venture capital companies. There are these, you know, small, then unknown, obscure little companies that invested little bits of money into lots of startups, tried to help them. Most of them failed, but the ones that succeeded really, really succeeded. You know, there's nearly no cap on the upside. And I thought, okay, that's what I want to do. Because I saw that as being able to work hard, have the impact. And, you know, there's the chance at least of uncapped gains, which you're just never going to get working for the Bank of New York.
Yeah. So what age were you when you ended up going to Imperial?
Imperial, I was 32.
Okay.
So Durham was 27 to 30.
Okay. So there's a bit of a period there from A-level time through Imperial time. There's this sort of decade and a bit of you discovering you had a brain, to coin your own phrase.
Yeah.
Like you thought you could cruise it through 18 or whatever age it was at A-level, but you got your ass kicked. And then you had this sort of probably internal narrative for the first half of your 20s where you're the doofus. And then you've got to kind of
I was really pissed off.
Mm.
You know, you can't go back in time, but if one could, I mean, I had a lot of fun at school. It was great, but yeah, I didn't work as hard as I should have done.
And this is what I'm interested in, is there's this sort of almost like narrative you said, like almost like you kind of, it's like you've got this period of your life where you didn't do it right and you had to put it back on track. I'm just kind of curious, like what was the impact of that? Sort of, it almost seems like an increasing amount of confidence through your 20s in going into your 30s when you're kind of learning and about yourself, but also learning about the world and learning what you really want and what motivates you and where to best apply your energies. So what was, again, looking back at that, looking back at sort of you at 20, and you at 30, what was the kind of big sort of learning over that time from the kind of confronting those failures and sort of exploring new directions?
Oh, crikey. I think it was like, you know, I'm responsible for this, so I've got to do something about it. And also, you know, there was a bit of luck and a bit of hard work. You know, I mean, I had to convince that guy to give me a gig at RBS, but he did. And then I had to really prove to him that it was the right decision. So, you know, that I think that was the first time in my career that I worked really, really hard. And then it's, you know, it was a big, I don't think I realized it much at the time, because I sort of always think, well, if I'm doing it, it's not that big a deal, you know, and if I've done it, well, it's not, you know, it's like running these marathons, right? I've run a marathon, so, you know, it's not that hard. But if I haven't done something, then I really ought to be able to do it. Like, I haven't done the MDS yet. I've got a place. Hopefully I'll be able to start and hopefully I'll be able to finish. But that's like a big goal for me. But once I've done it, all being well, it'll, you know, it's no longer such a big deal. And I don't think I realized it at the time, but like applying to those universities and giving up a, you know, what some people would see a hell of a career. You know, I was a senior consultant with a bank in New York with nice business cards, you know, flying business class up and down the country, you know, all that sort of stuff, decent salary, you know, great bunch of friends in the office. It was brilliant, but it was like, no, actually I haven't got a degree. Yeah, I could go do that. So I started applying and, you know, I suppose that was, you know, that was 3 years out, not earning any money, getting a bit of student debt, and all the rest of it, not knowing what was on the other side, you know, graduating in 2006. No idea what I really wanted to do after that. But I sort of had that goal and was determined to make it work.
Okay. So and what do you think, why do you think you left your cozy career with your high flying business cards and went to this sort of uncertain future?
Well, it was a bit out of fear. Like I said, that, I mean, not in our little bit of the bank, but you know, the bank as a whole was starting to lay people off. And I thought, shit, if there's a recession coming, I'm going to be out of a job with a couple of crappy A-levels and a bit of experience. You know, all the better consultants in our department had technical backgrounds. You know, they had degrees. And maybe I had a bit of a chip on my shoulder about not having one. But I thought, crikey, well, if I'm going to do something about it, now's a pretty good time.
Interesting. So, okay, so you sort of always brought, in a way, the sort of flow of things was sort of coming to a bit of a head, and you took that opportunity to bring it to a head and then go, okay, I'm going to tool up with a degree, I'm going to tool up with an MBA, I'm going to get some different kind of experience, and you oriented yourself in kind of, you want to work really hard, but have on this unlimited potential upside. This is one of what's really interesting now. Okay, so you're entering your kind of 30s with this different mindset, this different skill set in terms of your lessons that you're learning and what have you. And so the Imperial College experience seemed to be a bit of a kind of inflection point that sort of brought all that together. Now, so what happens after Imperial? I mean, again, I'm curious how you kind of got into the nine others thing and how that, so setting up a networking dinner thing, how does that fit into this guy who's got this shift in mindset and shift in skills?
Yeah, I mean, I never thought I'd be sitting here running a network, running a community. That really, you know, that wasn't on the careers department list of jobs. But yeah, I went through Imperial. It was brilliant because it, you know, my undergraduate was about 35, all male. You know, didn't really talk to each other except online. You know, very introverted techies, which was super. And then you go to Imperial and it's really different. You know, there's women, there's people from different backgrounds, there's marketing people, accountants, engineers, doctors. You know, the variety of people was fantastic at business school, and also the variety of subject matter. You know, like my undergraduate was really, really, I found really, really difficult, lots of maths, but, you know, got through it. Business school, it's not rocket science. There's just, the quantity of it is huge. That's the challenge. And then, you know, discovered venture capital, started looking into that, started looking into startups. And then I finished Imperial at the end of 2009. And then in 2010, there was a role advertised through the careers department, at a small investment company. And I applied to that. And that's the one I got. It was a company called Pembridge, and there were four partners. There was me, there was another member of staff. So it was the smallest company that I've ever worked for. And it was brilliant. I mean, it's the best job I've ever had working for someone else. It was fantastic. And the company did a couple of things. So the four partners did bits of investing themselves. You know, three of them were exited entrepreneurs, and there was a fund manager. They did bits of non-exec work, bits of advisory, fundraisers, all that kind of stuff, and bits of investment. And then the other half of the business, which was, you know, 80% of my work, was a fantastic program for London. So it was funded by the London government, and it was all about investment readiness. And this is at the beginning of this decade of entrepreneurship. So 2010, 2011, it was a bit weird to start a company. But people were doing it in scruffy offices in East London. And the the London government thought, well, if we can help these people, you know, they will get investment, they will create jobs, that'll be all great. So my company and a couple of other companies worked on this investment readiness program. And we did, you know, we did mentoring, we did events, we did practice pitch sessions with friendly VCs. We did, you know, it was like an education program. A lot of companies were reliant on grants, but they were drying up. So we kind of taught them in workshops, you know, what's the difference between an angel and a VC? And these companies were at all different levels. And there was a few networking events going on. So throughout the end of 2010, 2011, I was out at networking events at least three, four times a week after work. And, trying to talk to these startup founders to say, look, come on our program. It's funded. You'll get to come along and expand your network, meet some investors, learn some stuff. And it was brilliant. I mean, it was a fantastic program. We helped hundreds of companies, and dozens of those companies went on to raise millions of pounds of investment. And that's what led, in one or two ways, to starting Nine Others.
So describe Nine Others. I sort of sketched over it, but it's a networking dinner.
Yes. So as part of this investment readiness program, I came up with the idea that I saw in Silicon Valley, that they did dinners. So they did investor dinners. Jason Calacanis did it. And I thought, okay, that might work for us. So we did a series of networking dinners and breakfasts where we'd have, you know, maybe half a dozen startups that had either been through our program or were, you know, joined the program and were already ready for investment. And then we had, you know, four or five investors. So, you know, a couple of VCs, a couple of angels, but we'd got to know both sets of people. So it was really quite curated. So we knew the investors were ready, willing, and able to put their hand in their pocket and fund businesses. And we knew the startups were, you know, up to scratch. So we're ready to pitch to investors. So the startups would do a couple of minutes pitch each, and then be a bit of Q&A, all in amongst a nice dinner or a nice breakfast. And that was all great. And again, it was like off the chart successful. So it all led to follow-up meetings. A lot of it led to investment from those parties. And because our program was funded by the government, we didn't have to get involved in the deals. So we didn't take any other fees. We didn't take any other commission or anything like that. We were just there to kind of stir the pot and make this happen. And a couple of things from those dinners and that program led to what became Nine Others. One of them was at the end of all of these investor dinners, the entrepreneurs would kind of huddle together and talk to each other for the last, you know, 20, 30 minutes. And it used to really annoy us because we'd got them there to talk to the investors. But then it happened often enough that we thought, okay, what are they actually doing? So we figured out and we talked to them, and they were actually talking to each other just about the normal, general, everyday business of business problems that they kind of couldn't talk about anywhere else. So at the other bigger networking events and at ours earlier on, you know, they were in pitch mode. Everything had to be great. They were trying for investment. They were trying to hire staff. They were trying to get users or customers. You know, they're pitching. But actually, sometimes you need to talk about the challenges that you're facing. And a lot of that is, you know, money in, money out, people, talent. You know, where do you go for this? Where do you go for that? Who do you use for legals? Who do you use for accounting? And we saw that it was really, really useful for those founders to talk to other founders who were around about the same stage as them, but not in their business, right? Because sometimes you want to talk to someone that's not your co-founder, not your partner at home. You know, your friends in different jobs just don't understand what you're going through, but other founders do. So that was kind of one thing. And then the other thing was this project, we were so successful on it. We finished and we hit all our targets 4 months early. And such was the state of things. It was like, we hit our targets and they're like, okay, great, stop. You know, that's you've achieved your goal. Don't do any more. And that was in the November of 2011. And there was a rumor, there may have been another program starting in the March. So, you know, in 4 months' time. And me and my now Nine Others co-founder, Katie, we worked together on this project for the previous year. We sort of thought, well, if we get this new project in March, we're going to need a network of entrepreneurs to, you know, because we've got all this goodwill in 2011. And we thought, well, if we don't get, you know, if our companies don't get that project in the next March or it's delayed, we're probably going to need a network even more. So what can we do to kind of keep this network alive? So wanting to keep that network and that goodwill alive, plus seeing, you know, founders talking to other founders about their challenges, led us to sort of think, okay, what can we do just for the founders? And we'd run all these dinners. So we thought, well, let's try to do it a dinner just for founders. And similar to our investor ones, you know, we wanted them deliberately small. So that's why it's only ever 10 people. It's, you know, oneself and nine others, because we didn't want to get tempted into having bigger and bigger and bigger events, because we thought, let's just limit it. So deliberately small, you know, loosely curated in terms of who's there. So, you know, just founders, people working in startups who are coming up against these everyday business of business problems. And we did it over dinner. And we tried the first one on the 8th of December, 2011. And it's not really changed. As you experienced a couple of weeks ago, each person comes along, does a very brief intro. The more brief, the better, because what's more important is what's keeping you up at night. And then we spend 10, 15 minutes sort of kicking around that problem. You know, maybe someone else has experienced similar. How did they deal with it? maybe somebody's, you know, going to introduce you to someone who's had a similar challenge. Maybe you should read a book or an article or watch a video. You know, all these sorts of things help.
So this whole thing sort of segued into this sort of, there's a flow state here. You segued into nine others. And then I guess what I'm interested in, looking back from where you are now, so it's been a decade, well, and a bit of running these dinners. And you, I guess your career has shifted through that time. So at what point did you then get into investing? So this network's happening and the network's value that you would has grown up, but you've then started getting into investing. And what was the relationship between the two, or was there a relationship between the two?
Well, in the beginning, no. You know, Nine Others was just sort of a little side project that Katie and I decided to do alongside our day jobs. And because we had day jobs, we thought, well, let's just do one a month. You know, we'll keep it good quality people, you know, curate who's there. We'll see where it goes. You know, we did one in December and we thought, okay, that was great. Let's do another one in the January. So we did. People seemed to like that. And we said, introduce us to other people that might want to come or come back. So we did another in the February, another in the March. And that started going, you know, really well. I mean, at the very worst, me and her get to go to have a dinner with a bunch of nice people. I mean, it's just, you can't lose. But we just felt like if we keep doing that, we keep making these introductions, keep trying to have the network help the network and keep growing that, then, you know, something good will come from it amongst those people. And then eventually maybe something good will come back to us. But we didn't know what or when or how it would be, but we just had faith that something would. And, you know, I was, so my day job company was doing this investment as well. And, you know, that was always something that, you know, that was something that excited me. And that's why I got into it in the first place, to have this potential of, you know, uncapped returns. So I started a couple of other projects as well. Within the firm, we started an accelerator program for, you know, advertising and marketing technology companies. So I recruited all the startups to go through that program. So that was really good. But then, you know, I always wanted to have my own firm or be the boss, or just have it as, you know, my firm, my fund, you know, for me, rather than working as a, you know, as an associate for someone else. But I knew that would take a few steps and a long time. And, you know, I'm getting there now, but it's taken a few steps. And the sort of three main steps to doing that was, the first one, I started another side project, investing in students and graduates to start companies. So I got to know a guy called Nick Wheeler, who started Charles Tirrett Shirts, and he started that at university. He was very keen for other students and graduates to start companies. So I set something up with him. And he invested, you know, sort of 12 to 15K in a bunch of students that wanted to start companies, because I was well connected with the universities. So found and filtered through, you know, students that wanted to start companies. And these literally were, you know, a couple of mates with an idea. They had nothing, those teams that we invested in. You know, most of them, we had to help them incorporate the company so that Nick could do his investing and take some shares. And then Nick gave me some of his shares. So that was kind of step one. We did that with a bunch of companies, which one of those did very, very well. And then the second step was in 2016, 2017, I set up a couple of small funds for a Malaysian entrepreneur who wanted to do some investing in London. So again, you know, someone else's money, but I would gain from some of the upside. So that was all great. That was step two. And then in 2017 onwards was when, you know, I could sort of scrape together enough money to start doing angel investing myself. You know, I've had a couple of exits, but I've not had massive life-changing exits, certainly not back then. So it wasn't I'm not your typical angel investor who's sold a company, sitting on millions and investing a bit of that. I call it pay as you go angel investing. And I think this decade is going to see a lot more of that. And so that's what I do. And I suppose that's where the sort of blend and the crossover happened. you know, after doing a few years of nine others, sitting down and having dinner every month, talking about problems, talking about challenges, trying to help those entrepreneurs out, I think it sort of gave me a bit of, you know, unique intuition from all of those situations. You know, for me, it's always been about the people. You know, the people come along to Nine Others, and you know, I'm interested in what they're doing and how they think and where they're going. You know, not necessarily what business they happen to be doing at the minute, because people come back again and again doing different businesses. So it was always about the person, and that, you know, I think that's what sort of blended into doing investing. You know, has this person got a good idea? Are they really connected with that idea? But more importantly, do they have the grit to execute on that?
It's interesting. I think the pattern seems to be is this kind of meeting people, speaking to people, absorbing all this sort of the data, as it were, or the information, or the sort of the experiences to create the intuition that allows you to sort of navigate through. And I think one of the things I'm curious about actually is that you've had this 10-year experience of monthly dinners of people bringing in what's keeping them up at night. And looking back at that last decade, what's the number one thing that keeps people up at night?
I'll tell you the top three. And I think the third one is actually the top one that can solve it all. So often they fall into three sort of buckets, three categories. The first is about money. So money in, money out, you know, revenue, investment, cash flow, burn, all that kind of stuff. Money in, money out. People have challenges with that. The second is about talent, people in, people out. How do you find and recruit and tempt the best talent to join you? And also, how do you get rid of talent that's not suitable or not a good fit or not performing? So that's like people in and out. And then the last one that maybe doesn't get raised that much, but I think it can help solve the first two, is how to communicate. So how to communicate effectively to those groups of people. Because if you can communicate and tell the right story, you will get investors and customers. If you can communicate and tell that right story, you will bring in the right staff and communicate what you want from them and, you know, what you don't. So I think that would be the overall top one, is to think about how founders communicate to the different stakeholders and the different people. Because sometimes founders think, okay, I've got one deck or one pager, and that is, you know, the magic wand for all of these interactions. But it's not. It's much, much harder than that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think people underestimate the how difficult it is to actually get a message across to other people so they actually understand what it is that you do.
And it is. I really, really think it is just about getting that message across, right? It's not about, you know, being salesy. It's not about trying to convince people. It's just about telling your story. And then the right people will get on board with that. You know, my hero investor in the States is a guy called Chris Sacker, who was hugely influential in my thinking. And it's just gone the 10-year anniversary of him being on a podcast that I regularly rewatch. And he says in that, he says, look, I'm not here to convince you. You're just here to tell the story and get the right people along with it. It's sort of, you know, founders and should have that sense of inevitability. This is what's going to happen. This is what I'm doing. You know, it might take a short term, might take a long time, but this is the kind of path I'm on. And you're just on about, you know, trying to tell that story so the right people come with you.
Just from my own experience, sorry. Like, so when I had the blow up of the business, it was a kind of, I had a belief in my heart that I knew I could turn things around, or I believed I could. And I knew that we were onto something good. And actually, that sense of inevitability, I had this sort of, it's funny, isn't it? Because you have to have that sense of, I guess you're doing this with your vision of investing. It's like, okay, this is going to happen. It might take a long time. It might take a few sort of meandering steps. But if you kind of can believe in it yourself and have that feeling of inevitability, then your story you're telling, the future truth that you're kind of articulating, is much more compelling because you've got that kind of, I guess, the sort of energy that goes behind it.
Well, it's a deeper look. I mean, it comes and goes, right? But it's a deeper inner confidence of of that inevitability. And I think that's the thing I've learned over the last few years as well, is to think longer term, you know, do long-term things with long-term people, think in decades. You know, we've done 9 others for over a decade now. As you mentioned, where we've written a book about it. So we're getting that sorted out in the minute and getting that published. That is a story about the first 10 years and the things that we've learned. And that sort of makes us think what the next 10 years looks like, both for 9 others and for Katie and myself personally. Yeah, you've got to think longer term.
I love that. And I know something I think that a quote from Naval Ravikant there? Long-term things, yes, with long-term people.
He says, yeah, something about playing long-term games with long-term people.
That's the right, yeah. So I'm a bit of a Naval Ravikant fanboy. There's a great book called the Navalmanac. If you don't know Naval Ravikant, he's an investor come spiritual guru of Silicon Valley. But the Navalmanac, which I believe you can get for free, is definitely worth getting. You can get it for free as a PDF. And that particular gem, playing long-term games with long-term people, very much influenced my thinking at the tech department. And we've been going for like nearly 19 years now. So I'm looking at the next 20 years, me, and going, okay, what's the next game that I'm playing coming out of the blow up? And that's kind of what's unfolding for us at the moment.
Definitely. Okay. And I think of that with 9 others. Like a few years ago, I thought, well, if things go really, really well, and imagine one of these, you know, investments I make completely goes incredibly well, you know, blows up in a good way, and it's all super successful, I'll still do a 9 others dinner once a month. And then I think the reverse, you know, I think if it all goes horribly wrong and I lose loads and I lose everything, even then I can still do a 9 others dinner every month.
Yeah. And what's beautiful about what you've done, we've not touched on this perhaps, but there's a system, not a goal there. It's like a method that you just keep doing the system, and the sort of pursuit of a goal will come from the system. It's a byproduct of the system.
Charlie Munger talks about, it's either him or Warren Buffett, like, you know, get a simple idea and take it seriously.
Mm.
And it is super, super simple. I can't believe how simple 9 others was. And in the beginning, you know, nothing really came from it. It was just, it was enjoyable then, it's enjoyable now. But yeah, you just keep doing that simple thing, that kind of metronomic consistency of that system is what will work. And I just know that if I keep doing that, you know, for another 10 years and 10 years beyond that, you know, the investment opportunities will come, the collaboration opportunities will come, and it'll really, really pay off. But then again, it's like, well, so what if it doesn't? You know, at least I'll have met some interesting people, and it'll give a rich, interesting life.
And I think this is a beautiful moment to sort of dwell on here. I think you articulated there a really great argument for why you should be developing a network, as in you, the listener, should be developing your network, because things come out of that. There's a sort of karmic residue of like things and goodwill and paying it forward, etc. And I think the other point is it's fun. You know, you meet interesting people, you get some interesting stuff going on, and the journey is part of the point of this whole thing. And I think being too fixated on some future state where everything will be perfect is not the point. The journey should be the point.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, part of what made me go to business school and want to take that step between my 2 degrees was I looked at people who were working in my organization doing my kind of job. You know, I looked at what the people 10 years ahead of me, I looked at what their lives were like. And it was okay on paper. You know, they were earning good money. They were going on interesting holidays. They had a decent house in the suburbs and a couple of cars and kids and all this sort of stuff. But they were utterly, utterly miserable in their work. And they were trapped and they couldn't wait to leave their work. But they kept having to come back to it because they were trapped in that system. And I just didn't want that. And all I wanted was for it to be mostly good most of the time. You know, it's never going to be 100%, you know, amazing, but they just hated their lives, and I just didn't want to get 10 years down the road and be trapped like those people were. So that's when I started applying to business schools, changed roles.
I love it. Well, mostly good most of the time will be your T-shirt in the Honey, I Blow Up the Business merch store for the... Humble ambitions for great people.
So we're edging towards the end of our time together. Very quickly, 60 seconds. What advice should entrepreneurs ignore?
They should probably ignore most specific advice. Again, that should word that we talked about. Oh, you should do this. You should do that. You should never tell anybody what to do. I try not to convince people what to do. But what they should do is think what's right and what's most appropriate for themselves. You know, hoover up all of this knowledge and this advice, but then do some deeper thinking about what clicks with you. And most of the very specific actionable advice they should probably ignore, I think. And also ignore some of the conventions. Like there seems to be this convention about about sole founders in particular. I think sole founders are really underrated, and you shouldn't stop doing a company just because you happen not to have a co-founder. So some of those conventions, you know, raising money, well, maybe you don't need to, you know, think about how you might not do that. You know, accelerator programs, you know, like in the investment game, we're looking for outliers, but then everybody sort of seems to go down a very similar path. And if anybody is a true outlier, they sort of get ignored because they're not going down the similar path. You know, it's not two or three co-founders. They've not gone through an accelerator, et cetera, et cetera. But if you look at some of the remarkable, true, true outliers, it's often a sole founder who's not gone anywhere near an accelerator program, for example.
Interesting. Okay, this is a whole bunch of really interesting sort of perspectives on there. I mean, where can people find you? Where's best to find you online if we want to learn more about you?
Twitter. I do like Twitter. So even after I gave up LinkedIn, I've always liked and enjoyed Twitter. I am at M Stafford on Twitter.
Right. Check him out on Twitter. Tweet him. Don't LinkedIn him. I'm full of incredible story and really good insight there. And check him out on Twitter. Now he's back on LinkedIn. Check him on LinkedIn.
Just don't expect me to
No, we expect you to come back to you at any point. But it's full of wisdom now. I think loads of great takeaways. And I'm sort of, again, this whole thing of not relying on social media and actually being social and the power of that sociability, like that metronomic systemic once a month actually seeing people.
Yeah, you've got to engineer those sorts of things in your life. I invested in a company called Unplugged, and they do cabins just outside London where you go to the cabin for 3 nights and you lock away your phone in a box. And, you know, those sorts of things, we're not going to get rid of social media. We're not going to put all that technology back in a box. It's wonderful and I love it. But I do think that we have to engineer in our lives, you know, an unplugged break once a quarter, or a dinner where you don't take your phone once a month. You know, you've got to take responsibility for that.
On that bombshell, I was expecting you all to unplug and get to a dinner as soon as possible. So, yeah, great stuff. Really, thanks for sharing so openly, Matthew. It's really brilliant. Check him out on Twitter, and I'll see everybody next time.
Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box, just enter it in and we will send you that information, and it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.